Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. It's Ellie Steele and Lila. And tonight we're going to replay last night's show on Q10 from WQQQ.com and WQQQ 103.3 FM. And I hope you enjoy it. This is, and then we have with us, we'll explain it, author Bonnie Jones Reynolds and her new book from the Magdalene, and a lot of news and information coming up your way as well. So stay tuned, and this is, hope you enjoy it.
All right, good evening. It's the L.A. Steele Show, and I'm here tonight with the lovely Lila.
Good evening, folks.
And let's see, we got, there we go, volume is just right. And tonight we got an interesting show. We got a lot of news up front here, but also got an interesting author. Lila, you have the book there.
Yeah, it's Bonnie Jones Reynolds.
Yep.
And the book is a novel, The Magdalene.
Right.
And I think with the up-and-coming Christmas season, it's a good kind of read.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah.
It's a large book, about 700 pages.
Oh, yeah.
But it's... Lila really enjoyed it.
687, almost 700 pages. Yep.
Yeah, and I got to read part.
I'm only about halfway through it. So.
But it was enough, you know. I kind of read the last chapter and stuff and front stuff and all kinds of things. So I talked to the author today and. Fascinating lady, and we're going to talk
we'll
to
tell
her.
Well, she'll tell her story about how this book came about.
Quite an odyssey, actually, and we're going to talk about that tonight. And we've got John Brennan coming up at 9:30,
mm-hmm.
and we got Woody and Ring at 9:05. And so, and of course, Bonnie Jones Reynolds will be with us at 8:30. So between now and then, we got a lot of news, and we want to news and views. And we're going to go to that in just a second here. And I want to, hang on a second. And we'll bring up our
sponsor
in just a minute.
It takes a while to scroll that down, huh?
Well, it's got to, you know, it's the way it is.
Okay.
And anyway, yeah. So I wanted to.
I can start off with a bit of news
jump
if
right
you like.
Stuff here, yeah.
Why is Greenland so rich these days? This is by Alex Singleton, World. Let's see. Britain used to have about 80% of European fish stocks. If you think that leaving the EU would be catastrophic, take a look at Greenland. By rights, its people ought to be poor. Their island is isolated, suffers from freezing weather, has a workforce of only about 28,000 and relies on fish for 82% of its exports. But it turns out since leaving the EU, Greenland has been freed of EU red tape and the destruction of the common fisheries policy, that the average income of islanders today is higher than those living in Britain, Germany, and France. Greenland's politicians realized that the fishery policy was ruining their fishing industry. They had the guts to stand up against all the prophets of doom and let their people vote in a referendum on leaving the European Community, as the EU was then called, on January 1, 1985. It became independent of Brussels, the only country ever to do so. Greenland was with Britain one of the only two EU countries to be heavily dependent on fishing. In fact, Britain had, in some estimates, 80% of Europe's fish stocks when it entered the EU. Because our fishermen had... just a minute, I got to go to the next page. Had carefully managed them, while the fishermen of Spain, France, and Italy had destroyed most of the Mediterranean stocks. The surprising thing is that while the unemployment from closing coal mines is frequently denounced by labor politicians, more British workers lost their jobs as a result of gigantic French and Spanish boats being permitted to raid their stocks, fish stocks they're talking about. Few of those politicians seem to care. But care they should, because it is not just the fish where the EU is damaging us, but in financial services, manufacturing. Indeed, its ever-increasing regulations impose unnecessary costs across the whole of our economy. Greenland, which retains free trade with the EU, shows that we can have the benefits of European exports without the cost of its dictates. It's surely time that we, too, said goodbye to Brussels. And that's Britain talking, the author of this article. This is The Telegraph, from thetelegraph.co.uk. Alex Singleton, and he has some good things, because as a follow-up to that, maybe I should say what's going on in a lot of countries.
Okay, yeah, go ahead with the EU.
Yeah, this is from the Activist Post. So remember I just read about Greenland, how successful they are. Listen to this. The international bankster machine seeking to colonize Western nations through debt is now meeting resistance from Greece to France to Ireland to Italy to Spain to Portugal and to the UK. These new protests in Ireland and Italy follow a crippling two-week strike in France, where citizens took over fuel refineries and other vital infrastructure, more strikes in Greece, which took over the Acropolis, and a massive student protest in the UK that caused physical damage to government buildings. All of these protests were sparked by government reducing benefits or increasing fees and taxes on a population that has little to do with the private gamblings of banks. These European protests are intensifying as the international bankers move to collect the pound of flesh through austerity and sale of public assets. As Europeans are becoming acutely aware of the dubious plan to loot them, and the anger of their corrupt and elected officials for bowing to banks has reached a boiling point. In all cases, the governments are enforcing austerity measures on the people after the private banks overleveraged themselves to the breaking point, threatening to bring down the entire nations. For years, the bankers churned out easy credit to these nations while they invested public and private funds into worthless credit default swaps and derivatives. As if orchestrated to perfection, they pulled the plug on these toxic assets, essentially bankrupting the more fragile developed countries, followed by calling the debt due. Now they're demanding that European governments be forced into IMF bailouts that impose drastic austerity measures on the people, while the banksters get away with what they've done. By forcing tax increases and reducing benefits for the citizens of sovereign nations, the IMF is essentially rewriting the laws. Well, it appears that the citizens of Europe have had enough. The massive protests, strikes, and riots that have swept through the streets of many European countries have resulted in growling calls to reject the bailout money, used to prop up failed banks and corrupt governments. The Irish people prefer to default on the debt, which drove the EU completely mad. That's pretty good. So that's what's going on in the rest of Europe. So remember, Greenland, doing fine, very rich country, not tied to the EU. Now, these other countries, Greece, France, Ireland, Spain, Italy, and the UK, not doing very well, tied to Brussels and their corrupt bankster schemes. Very similar to what's happened here. So, Leo, how are we doing with our sponsor?
Yeah,
are we coming up to that?
Proud to serve you. They keep our streets and parks clean.
They make our schools a great place to learn.
They keep violent felons out of our community.
They even help our children get to school safe and on time.
They are the 35,000 public service employees represented by Council 4.
These employees are dedicated and efficient.
They are accountable to Connecticut taxpayers. That means they don't work for privatized agencies that may hire substandard non-union workers.
Companies like these are constantly in the headlines with their corruption scandals, which cost taxpayers millions.
That's why it's important to keep public services in public hands with people who work hard around Connecticut and around the clock.
On the state and the local level.
Public service employees are proud to serve you every single day.
Find out more at council4.org. Council 4, AFSCME, a union for all. This ad is brought to you by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. This union is affiliated with the AFL-CIO.
All right, we're back. And we thank AFSCME.
Leo, I was wondering what you thought about that, about Greenland, for one thing, left the European Union, and what you thought about what was happening with the populace in these European countries who are tied to the European Union, and how do you think that will affect the plans here to have...
Well, I think there's another article, I think you have it, there's another one on Iceland.
I just...
But the Iceland one, fascinating enough, I mean, Iceland went belly up back in 2009.
Right.
And
they refused to bail out the banks.
And they refused to bail out the banks. And the banks failed. And Iceland went on happily ever after and is doing fine.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I believe that we should let these damn banks fail here. All right? Just let them go under. All right? And everything will be fine. All right.
Well,
we got plenty of, we can print up plenty of money, all right, and take over the whole process because that's what we're supposed to do constitutionally. We don't need these damn banks. We don't need them, okay? Nobody needs them. They're just parasites.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And when
people don't bail them out, they seem to do just fine.
And we've talked about this before, and we brought up Alan Brown on the show and talked about creating a state bank and, in that process. And North Dakota is the only state in the country that has a state bank, all right?
And they're doing
the only
fine,
state
folks.
In the country that has like 3% unemployment and
no
state deficit and everybody's fine, all right? And the only state in the country, and that's because they have a state bank. And we should just, have a state bank is okay, but, hey, why have banks?
I brought that up to our representative, and
that ain't gonna happen.
Sent her an article. Never heard anything more.
That ain't gonna happen, Lila. I mean, nobody understands the concept of this, and nobody, even if they do, you're up against these huge banking lobbies that you might as well just walk up to the guillotine and have your head chopped off because the banking company, the banks are the ones that run this country. These banksters, these goddamn banks.
Well, obviously they don't run North Dakota.
Oh no, but they are. God, man, these banksters are bastards. But anyway, let's go on. I've got this thing right here. I wanted to read this. I can't read this whole article, but I'm going to read a part of it because I kind of like it. And it's called "Power and the Tiny Acts of Rebellion." That's on Truthdig. And by Chris Hedges.
Oh, yeah, that's a good article.
And there is no hope left for achieving significant reform or restoring our democracy through establishing mechanisms of power. The electoral process has been hijacked by corporations. The judiciary has been corrupted and bought. And the press shuts out the most vital voices in the country and feeds us the banal and of the absurd. Universities prostitute themselves to corporate dollars. Labor unions are marginal and ineffectual forces. The economy is in the hands of corporate swindlers and speculators, and the public, enchanted by electronic hallucinations, remains passive and supine. We have no tools left within this power structure in our fight to halt unchecked corporate pillage. The liberal class, which Obama represents, was never endowed with much vision or courage, but it did occasionally respond when pressured by popular democratic movements. This was how we got the New Deal, civil rights legislation, and the array of consumer legislation pushed through by Ralph Nader and his allies in the Democratic Party. in the Democratic Party, rather. And The complete surrendering of power, however, to corporate interests means that those of us who seek nonviolent yet profound change have no one within the power elite we can trust for support. The corporate coup has ossified the structures of power. It has obliterated all checks on corporate malfeasance, and it has left us stripped of the tools of mass organization that once nudged the system forward toward justice. Obama knows where power lies and serves these centers of power. The tragedy, if tragedy is the right word, is that Obama, after selling his soul to corporations, has been discarded. Corporate power doesn't need brand Obama anymore. They have found new brands in the Tea Party, Sarah Palin, and Glenn Beck. Obama has been abandoned by those who once bundled contributions for him by the millions of dollars. Obama and the Democratic Party will, I expect, spend the next 2 years being even more obsequious to corporate powers. Obama clearly loves the pomp and privilege of statescraft that much, but I am not sure it will work. Reformers on the outside, while they remain militant and faithful to issues of justice, nevertheless depend on the liberal establishment to respond to pressure, to public pressure. If these reformers cannot pressure the liberal class and the power elite to evoke real change, they become ineffectual. Our fate is intimately tied to the liberals who have betrayed us. We speak in the language of policies and issues. We will find it harder and harder, given our impotence, to compete with the impassioned calls for new glory, revenge, and moral purity that resonate with the public beset by foreclosures, long-term unemployment, bankruptcies, and a medical system that abandons them. Once any political system ossifies, once any mechanisms for reform close, the lunatic fringe of a society, as I saw in Yugoslavia, rises out of the moral swamp to take control, and the reformers, however well-meaning and honest, finally have nothing to offer, and they are disarmed. We have reached a point where stunted and deformed individuals, whose rapacious greed fuels the plunge of tens of millions of Americans into abject poverty and misery, determine the moral fiber of the nation. It is not more morally justifiable, or rather, it is no more morally justifiable to kill someone for profit than it is to kill that person for religious fanaticism. And yet, from beneath, from health companies to the oil and natural gas industry to private weapons contractors, individual death and the wholesale death of ecosystem that become acceptable corporate business. The mounting human misery in the United States, which could lead to the sporadic bursts of anger we have seen on the streets of France, will be met with severe repression from the security and surveillance state, which always accompanies the rise of the corporate state. The one method left open by which we can respond, massive street protests, the destruction of corporate property and violence will become the excuse to impose total tyranny. The intrusive pat-downs at airports may soon become a fond memory of what it was like when we still had a little freedom left. All reform movements, from the battle for universal health care to the struggle for alternative energy, insane environmental controls to financial regulation to an end to our permanent war economy, have run into this new terrifying configuration of power. They have confronted an awful truth. We do not count. And they have been helpless to respond to those who are most skilled in the manipulation of hate, led by a confused populace to call for their own enslavement. And there's just one more paragraph here. I wanted to, actually two, but Margaret Flowers, a pediatrician from Maryland, who volunteers for Physicians for a National Health Program, knows what it is to challenge the corporate leviathan. She was blacklisted by the corporate media. She was knocked out of the debate on health care reform by the Democratic Party and liberal organizations such as Move On. She was abandoned by those in Congress who had once backed calls for a rational health care policy. And when she and seven other activists demanded that the argument for universal health care be considered at the hearing hearings held by Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus. They were forcibly removed from the hearing room. And the she says that the reform process exposed how broken our system is. Flower said that when we spoke a few days ago, the health reform debate was never an actual debate. Those in power were very reluctant to have single-payer advocates testify to come to the table. They would not seriously consider our proposal because it was based on evidence of what works, and they did not want the evidence placed before the public. They needed the reform to be based on what they thought was politically feasible and acceptable to the industries that fund their campaigns. And it goes on a bit, but the final paragraph on this, I felt it was powerful and should be read. It is time to think of resistance in a new way, something that is no longer carried out to reform a system, but as an end in itself. African Americans understood this during the long night of slavery. German opposition leaders understood it under the Nazis. Dissidents in the former Soviet Union knew this during the nightmare of communism. Resistance in these closed systems was local and often solitary. It was done with the understanding that evil must always be defied. The tiny acts of rebellion, day after day, month after month, year after year, and decade after decade, exposed to everyone who witnessed them the heartlessness, cruelty, and inhumanity of the oppressor. They were acts of truth and beauty. We must take to the streets. We must jam as many wrenches into the corporate system as we can. We must not make it easy for them, but we must also no longer live in self-delusion. This is a battle that will outlive us, and if we fight even with this tragic vision, we will lead lives worth living and keep alive another way of being. And I suggest you go to that article. It's under truthdig.com. Check it out. Worth a read. And we got just a few more minutes. Did you have something? Because I wanted to bring up that Burger King article. But I thought that's quick. And then you could bring up that farm article, which was really quite bad. Okay?
Which farm article?
The one where they foreclosed, where they went after the cheese guy.
Oh, that was awful.
Yeah, why don't you read that? Because we won't have much time tonight to read anymore.
Okay.
All right, but I let me get this. So everybody knows, Burger King's new healthy meal for kids is mostly hype. The media is from naturalnews.com. The media is applauding a recent announcement by Burger King introducing new healthy menu items designed to appeal to kids. Apparently the term healthy is relative. While it may be a baby step in the right direction, one is left thinking, gee, Burger King, is this really the best you can do? The new menu items are part of the pledge to take more action in promoting children's nutrition and making the pledge of the Council of Better Business Bureaus. And Burger King joins 11 other food and beverage companies claiming to be committed to advertising and promotes healthy dietary choices. And featured on their menu are Kraft macaroni and cheese, apple slices, and chocolate milk. While the macaroni and cheese is probably right on par with a burger, the apple slices and milk certainly shine compared to French fries and soda. But before you decide to head for Burger King, let's take a closer look. Believe it or not, Kraft, this kills me. Believe it or not, Kraft used to make real cheese. The company wanted to supply America with low-cost, easy-prepared cheese products. But like all real food, the cheese was perishable. So the laboratories at Kraft came up with a processed cheese formula based on milk solids that wouldn't spoil. They called it American cheese. But the American public said, yuck. And undaunted, Kraft looked itself took itself to the U.S. Army and convinced them to buy 6 million pounds of the stuff. And after a steady diet of it, the soldiers home from World War I wanted it on their dinner tables. And during World War II, when times were tough and food was rationed, Kraft introduced packets of dried, grated American cheese. The reception, again, was underwhelming until a clever salesman tied packets of the processed cheese to boxes of macaroni and convinced store owners to sell it as a single item. And Kraft saw what a hit it was, manufactured its own boxes of macaroni with a cheese packet inside, and Kraft Dinner was born. And if times had been better, those little boxes might have been rejected and never become an American tradition. And now Burger King is intent on passing the tradition on to your kids. So what's in it? Can't believe what's in it. All right. So, I want you to go to that article because it's about three pages. And it tells you what's in this American cheese and Happy Meals and all this crap. So go to naturalnews.com and check out Burger King's new healthy meals for kids.
The one thing that you didn't read in that article, which just really killed me, they made the apples look like French fries.
Oh, no.
So healthy food has to look like junk food for people to eat it?
Yeah, really.
And put in a caramel sauce, dipping sauce, or something repulsive.
Here we go. There's enough high glycemic carbohydrates to give anyone a real insulin spike. Enough of those spikes, and you are on the road to diabetes. And they're talking about the crap that's in these meals.
Oh, terrible.
And in this cheese.
Oh, and they don't even leave the skin on the apples, and that's where most of the nutrition is, apparently.
There's plenty of salt to ensure the water retention, sending you on your way to high blood pressure and heart disease, and there's a meager amount of protein along with the preservatives and food coloring to start you on your way to ADHD and Alzheimer's disease, and a cheap version of vitamin B1 that contains colon cancer promoting nitrate. So there you go. And a 2.4 serving of apple fries has 35 calories compared to a small serving of Burger King French fries that has 230 calories. All right. The apples are grown in the U.S. and cut and packaged in a sterile environment, treated with and washed down and contain lemon to keep them from turning brown. They don't tell you what else the pre-wash contains. Not bad, except when you realize that the bulk of the nutrition of the apple is contained in the skin. The chocolate milk is 1% white, or Hershey's milk is 1% of chocolate, and resealable 8-ounce packages, and a serving of sugar sweetened milk contains, and they tell you. So please go to that article on naturalnews.com. And I got to call our guest right now, and Lila, would you like to read the...
No, it's too long. I can mention, I was going to read that article. No, I'll just let me tell a little bit about our guest in the back here.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm going to call her.
This is about the author, and the name of the book is The Magdalene. Our author is Bonnie Jones Reynolds. She was born in Utica, New York, and raised on a dairy farm that had been in her family since 1820. She graduated from Clinton Central High School, and she headed to New York City, where she had a multifaceted career as a model, dancer, and actress, and with one lead in a Broadway show to her credit. She relocated to Hollywood, and she appeared in many popular TV series, including MASH, which was produced by her then-husband, Gene Reynolds. During the years of her marriage, Bonnie also wrote her first two best-selling novels, The Truth About Unicorns and The Confetti Man. After her divorce, Bonnie lived for some years in Australia and wrote Vic Ron's beginning yoga class at the request of her yoga teacher. This book has been in continuous print since 1978 and so forth. This is in the back of her book, tells a little bit more about her, but you get the gist of it, folks. She's had a very interesting life, and now she's written this book, The Magdalene, which had an interesting sort of journey before it got published, and we'll let Bonnie tell you about it herself.
Hello, Bonnie. How are you?
Hi there.
Welcome to the show. I'm Lila. It's nice to have you on, Bonnie.
Myra, thank you very much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here again.
Good. Your book, The Magdalene, had an interesting journey to publication, and I think you should share that with our audience before you tell us about your book.
Well, it was actually written. I finished it in, I think, late 1983. I first sent it to my then agent, and she was very upset with it, and she showed it to some people. people who were also upset with it, and she gave it back to me saying, "You can't publish that. You can't say these things. I mean, this just is not publishable." This was long before the Da Vinci Code and some of the other books that have come out since that touch on some of the topics that are in the Magdalene and have gained, you know, a great deal of public acceptance. But so I put the thing in a trunk because I next sent it to my editor, who had been my editor on my first two novels, and she wanted to cut it in half and change the ending. And I said, no. This thing came pouring out of me. Whenever Josh, who we would know as Jesus, or Maravi, who we would think of as the Magdalene, began to speak in this book, I don't even remember writing it. I had help. I believe so strongly in this thing that it's a message that has to get out there, and I knew that its time would come. So I put it away in a trunk, and it was in that trunk the night that our premises burned down, and I thought it was lost forever. And it was some years later when a friend of mine from Australia asked me if I wanted that copy of that book I had sent to him. I had totally forgotten that I miniaturized this thing and sent it to him. So he got it back to me, but it was in a miniature state. And this was back in the late 1990s, and the business of scanning was still in its infancy, and whenever you scanned something, you'd have a few words that made sense, and then the rest would be gobbledygook.
True.
So it took me 3 years to retype the thing.
Wow.
Then another year or so, because I was, as I was retyping, I was rewriting and adding to it, and of course, doing much more research, because by then, There was even more wonderful things had come to light. For instance, the fact that they have found in Caesarea a memorial stone, which shows that Pontius Pilate was not a procurator. He was a praefectus, which was a higher rank than procurator. And it's very obvious that the people who wrote the first four books of the Bible didn't know what they were talking about. There were many things that they didn't know what they were talking about. So anyway, then I got another agent, and she didn't really, care for the thing either. She was a little bit leery of it. And so I finally decided to self-publish, which is what I have done. And the Magdalene is now published as it's supposed to be, not cut in half and without the ending changed.
I was impressed actually with your fortitude there, because we have the same publisher as well, and I'm grateful for that. I felt that there was something about the book. I found myself, no matter where I opened it up to, I found that I could become engrossed with whatever chapter or whatever line or paragraph I was in. There's a uniqueness to your voice that captures you
yeah.
And it draws you into the characters, and of course it's an unusual story line, because it's not, you know,
it's not the traditional
Jesus, Mary, and Joseph kind of have a horrible ending.
They're real people in this book. They're not
very, yeah, very much so.
My question to you is, who are you in the book?
If I knew, I wouldn't tell you.
I know
I was there. People say to me, okay, so you say that when Jesus or Maravi would begin to speak, you don't remember writing it. And they say, well, oh, you were channeling. No, I don't believe I was channeling. I was remembering.
Mm.
I think I heard. I think I heard the words being spoken by these people. I think I was one of the people who sat at their feet.
Mm.
And I'm a foot soldier who was sent back and told to be here 2,000 years hence in order to get this message out. And there are many, many, many of us.
Yes.
I'm not the only one. There's a whole army of foot soldiers out there. You're probably foot soldiers, too, because you're responding to the book the way you are.
Yeah, I picked it up. Leo got the book, and I said, I've always been interested in that. Maybe I'll read that. And I'm about halfway through your book. I haven't finished it yet because I actually read a little bit each day, and I like doing it that way because it's sort of like the only way I can express it is it's sort of like fine Belgian chocolate. You like a little bit at a time because you want to savor it.
I was just going to add that this is it's a great compliment because Lila is one who will read the first, the middle, and last chapters of a book, you know, and if she doesn't really care for it, she'll just get to, you know. But with this one, she's just been working at it, you know, day by day, and you know, when she has the time, and she's just been really enjoying it. She says, "Boy, I really like this book," you know, and. And I've been reading it myself, and she's gotten further than I have. But I gotta say, I did cheat and I read the last couple chapters, so I know how it ends.
Don't give it away.
I won't do that. But I will be going back and rereading because I do enjoy your writing so much. You have a very remarkable ability to capture especially in a very long narrative like that, where you a novel, you're able to continue with that voice and that tension and the interactions of the characters and the scenes, and I was impressed. I really was.
Now, what I particularly like is the voice of Josh or Jesus, who tells us that, you know, that we are all linked to that universal consciousness, which I truly believe,
mm-hmm.
and that it is our own responsibility to connect in the best way to that and act in the best way that we can.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's why I love your book so much, because he says just what I believe myself. And that you really don't need anybody to interpret God for you. You just have to look inside, because he's there.
Yes.
If you call it God or universal spirit of
voice. I meant to ask you that, too. When we spoke earlier today, I wanted to ask you, but if you ever ran across a disciple named in the research named Barnabas?
Yes.
You did. All right, and Barnabas was the his scribe.
Mm-hmm.
So and that text came out. We had a doctor Kasim Khalil came on several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He published a book on Barnabas, and it was fascinating, and it kind of stated everything. And what was your take on that?
Well, I give the scribe a different name in this
right.
book. You'll find as you go.
I noticed that many names were different, so it was like.
Yes, Barnabas. There is a differing opinion on who Barnabas was. Some people say he was a cousin of the Magdalene.
Right.
Others say that he was a cousin of Jesus himself.
Right.
It's not certain who Barnabas was. I do have a character of a minor character of Barnabas in the book.
Hmm.
But the scribe, I give another name and a very different story. Which Myra, if you've gotten halfway through the book, you probably met the scribe already.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, I was pleased in it. So that was based on the Barnabas character.
Now, how did your book, your writings compare with your traditional understanding of Christianity, the way you were brought up?
Oh, well, I was brought up Methodist,
mm-hmm.
And I when I got to New York City and started modeling and started, associating with people who weren't Methodists and had other ideas in the world, I was quickly given a lot of reading material, which led me to believe that everything I had been taught was a lie. And so I swung to full atheism. But this did not set well with me for long, and then I became agnostic. And my whole life, I'm 72 years old, by the way.
Oh, you are. Your voice sounds so young and strong.
Yeah.
Well, if you would see me, you would probably think the same thing. I seem to have weathered very, very well. But you threw me off the track with that compliment. What were I just saying?
You were talking about your traditional Christian.
My whole life has been a search.
Yep.
For, what is really going on and who am I and what's it all about, Alfie?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been through just about everything and studied just about everything. The turning point for me was January 20th, 1980. When I picked up a book called Seth Speaks by Jane Roberts.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I thought, as a matter of fact, I have a picture sitting in front of me right now that was taken of me as I sat on the deck in Malibu with the Pacific Ocean behind me starting to read Seth Speaks. It's one of my favorite pictures in the world because it's like a rebirth for me. Suddenly, everything made sense. And everything has made sense since. I'm definitely a student of Seth.
But there are, as far as Seth, there are several mediums
mm-hmm.
that are stating that they are Seth, and or translating Seth. And I don't know. Several people have approached me with that with these things, and I've read them and I've found them to be a little strange.
Well,
not accurate.
I think people should stick with Jane Roberts, the books of Jane Roberts.
Well, see that there
you're,
again,
the one and only Seth there. I don't know whether other people are actually communicating with some part of Seth or whether they're kidding themselves. I couldn't comment on that.
I sense that they are because there've been some people that I've known actually that have approached me with this concept and I've checked their sources and they're not who you stated there. What was her name?
Jane Roberts.
Have you met with Jane Roberts?
I beg your pardon?
Sources.
Have you met with Jane Roberts yourself?
Oh, I never met Jane Roberts. She's been dead for some years now. I communicated with her by mail a
mm-hmm.
couple of times.
Oh.
But and also with Robert Butts, her husband. But no, I'm sad to say I never did meet them, but they gave so much of themselves in those books that one feels that one knows them.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm not degrading or downplaying that role, but I mean, there wasn't Jane Roberts that I was told about. There was some other. A friend of mine once told me that wherever there's a click, there's a clack, you know. And so wherever wherever you have an original, you always have a fake. You know what I mean? So so then that happens. But but whether or not they are, I don't know. And I mean, who's to say that it doesn't, they don't talk to all. But who actually was Seth?
Well, Seth called himself an energy essence personality. He is a very advanced being. He basically comes to us from universes you use the word civilization, but I mean that's a very pale word of realities far above ours. But he loves teaching. He loves the earth. He loves to come here. He loves to teach.
Is he by any chance another name for Thoth or for Hermes or for
Well, of course, supposedly the first son of Adam and Eve back in that mythology was Seth. I believe I'm correct in saying that he was asked that very question somewhere in the Seth material, and he said no, he had nothing to do with that initial Seth. That Seth was just a name that he chose that epitomizes him. You know,
I say that only because
he has a name that in our hearts and souls means us to us. And to him, Seth was a compilation of letters that meant him to him.
Right.
Now, have you been able to contact him yourself?
Yes. But my business partner and I are for a while we're very active on the Ouija board. And after Jane's death, we communicated with her, and a couple of times Seth came through.
Well, it was Robert Merrill who I think it was Robert Merrill, the poet Merrill. I think it was Robert Merrill who actually did his greatest works were done on a Ouija board.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, are you familiar with his work?
No, I'm afraid I'm not.
Yeah, he was. Heir of Merrill Lynch, I think, but it was Robert. I think his name was Robert Merrill, and his greatest poetry was he attributed to his work on the Ouija board.
Yeah.
So it was kind of strange, but getting aside from that, I understood the change, but perhaps that's what interested me in your book was because as I got into it, I could see some of the I've identified. I've worked with channeled work. Throughout many years, and have seen it and read it, and yours had a ring of authenticity to it. And I didn't say anything about it to Lila, but she kind of, and she's more of a skeptic than I, but she could see it right away. There was something drawing her to the text, and I felt very strongly like. That's why every time I picked the book up, I could read different sections and I could sense that spiritual aspect working through each line, and as in some form of channel text. I really enjoyed reading it. I suggest to a lot of people that this is an interesting book.
And it would make a wonderful gift for this time of the year, I think, because it so humanizes the people around Jesus and. Also Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people, and I mean it sincerely, I offer people a money-back guarantee. And I say to them, if you don't like this book, I'll give you your money back. I have yet to have to give anybody their money back.
Oh, that's good.
Because, as you say, there is something magical in the pages, and I cannot take full credit for that. Yes, I'm a good writer. And I'm able to put words together in a very good way. But there was something else over and above that that was working. And as you say, through every word in this book, your reaction is you're echoing what most of my readers echo. You know, they say it's the kind of thing you want to turn the page because you want to know what's happening, but you're so busy on the page you're on.
Yes.
Yeah, figuring the whole thing and really getting into it that, you know, you don't really get to turn that page. So it is the kind of book that you can put on your desk or
on
your
table
and open it every day and read a page or two and you know, just still be getting the whole thing without reading the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the thing that's exciting about the book that I've seen so far is like I said, you can pick it up and you can read, you can skim through it, and in each area you can and wherever you land, okay, you can find something fascinating within that paragraph or that sentence or that page, and you wind up reading through it and picking things up from wherever. It's because it's like vignettes of real life. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're jumping into reality on each page, but something with a history that you're familiar with.
Golly, can I send you two out on a national tour for this book?
Well, that's a great compliment.
Yeah, I guess, but I don't know what I'm doing with this book. I'm not totally. It's one of these kind of books. I think I'll reread. I'll eventually read the whole thing from front to back and go back and keep going, because there are a number of books that I have in my life that I've done the same thing with. And, you know, most of them are books of essays or something like that, or short stories or novels. But I'll keep going back to them over time and time and time again over the many years.
There is one person I know who was starting through for the fourth time.
Wow.
Really?
I wanted to ask you, did the writing of this book change you at all?
Yes. Yes, it definitely has. The book is a very strange thing. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at a copy, and it's... there is a great deal of me in it, and yet it doesn't belong to me. It's as though it's a gift that I was given to give to people, to the world. I have no ego involved in this thing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as I say, I'm not quite sure that I wrote it. I know I remember doing, you know, I mean, 3 or 4 years of very serious, you know, digging through libraries and books. And this was before you had the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now you get on the Internet and you just put in Pontius Pilate, and, boy, you have, you know, 50 different tracks that you can study on Pontius Pilate. But... back then, you had to go to a library, and you had to, you know, really search out this stuff. So I did all of the scholarship on the thing, but that I would say, and my ability to write well are my two contributions to the book. Other than that, it's a gift for humanity.
Now, how did it change? Did it change you spiritually, or change? Change the way you look at our reason for being here?
I think basically it settled me more. It made me calmer.
Mm.
It took away any fears. I mean, I can't. Oh, sharks! Yes, I'm still afraid of sharks. That's about the only thing in the world that I'm afraid of. It's just a matter of, as though a calming, soothing presence settled over me, and gives me the ability to transmit this to other people, and to act this way with other people, and to impart some of what I'm feeling to them.
Mm-hmm. And how did the people around you feel about this book? I mean, you wrote it quite a long time ago before it got published.
Well, my mother was terrified of what her Bible class would think.
Oh, really?
my sister was terrified that someone might try to assassinate me because of some of the things that are in there.
Mm-hmm.
But my sister, at the same time, is for Christmas, is giving a copy of it to her minister.
So she's come to terms with it, huh?
Yeah.
No, everyone around me, I have not found anybody, and this is so wonderful to me. And again, I say this without ego, because of what the Magdalene is. It's a thing apart from me, but I have yet to find anyone who was not basically caught up by it and entranced by it.
Oh.
And interestingly enough, some of the people who are... I was just talking with one yesterday, a friend of mine who is a staunch Catholic, and she bought the book, and she saw me on the street, and she said, "Bonnie," she said, "I am loving that book. I am just loving it." She said, "You know, I haven't been able to read much because, you know," she said, "you can't read that thing fast." But she said, "I am just loving every minute of it." And I'm getting this reaction from so many of my Catholic friends.
Well, I think, yeah, let me say just one thing, and I think that it might help, because I think that I've always questioned the deity of Christ. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody has, okay, unless they
even if they don't say it as
even
a word.
If they don't say it, okay. And you know, the divinity of Christ has always been an issue, and there's so much to attest to that. But I recall this particular book of Barnabas, and stating that Christ would continue, or Christ Jesus would continue to, he would be right, and his disciples, if they called him divine,
of course,
and he would say, I'm not, you know, I'm not divine, I'm not God. In fact, the thing that probably confused me the most as a child, all right, trying to understand the divinity of Christ, was that the first thing you learn are the Ten Commandments, all right? And the first commandment is, thou shalt not have any other God before me. Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
All right? And all of a sudden, here's Christ. You know what I mean? Here's Jesus. He's me. You know what I mean? Well, isn't that total and absolutely contradictory to what the Ten Commandments says, or to what God says?
Well, the fact that
the
idea that Jesus was the Son of God was decided somewhere in the 4th century.
But I think the absurdity of that whole argument was that we are all sons and daughters of God.
This is it, absolutely.
You know,
and the interesting thing is, I don't know whether you're into the quantum physics at all, into the new physics, but this is exactly the interesting thing about the new physics, quantum theory, is that they are going to end up proving everyone has always looked for proof of God. They are going to end up proving by their various theories and their various experiments, you can't not come to any other conclusion except that the whole universe is a vast mind, a vast consciousness of which we are a part. All of our atoms are the same atoms, whether they're on Jupiter or Sirius or Antares, or whether they're in the ocean, or whether they're in your dog, or whether they're in your table, or the floor you're walking on. They are all the same, absolute same God stuff.
And I have to agree with you. Mm-hmm. I have to agree with you. And every mystic,
and you better be nice to your dog, because he may come back and be your master.
No, but every mystic that of any, you know, credibility, all right, has basically said the same thing.
Yeah.
All right, has seen God in everything.
Uh-huh.
And everyone,
and this is what Jesus tried to tell people.
That's right. That's correct.
When he said to his disciples, "You will do as I am, greater." He was saying, "You're the same as I am. We are all the same. I am no greater than you are."
And he said, "What I do, you can do."
Mm-hmm.
You know,
more and more.
And more, exactly.
He was our model.
Right.
Yes.
And
he was modeling for us what we can do if we use what we have. But that's only...
He was like Seth. Like mm-hmm. Seth. He is, because he
was a teacher,
exists at this point. He never has ceased to exist and never will cease to exist.
Mm. But it is exactly
us.
In that, right.
But he is a super, very, very highly advanced soul.
Oh, yeah. But again... So are these other teachers that that I spoke about, and Thoth and Hermes, who are all both the same, to the same teacher, the same people, just in different times. With different
Muhammad,
names.
Buddha and Muhammad were great teachers, teachers.
But all of these religions have been twisted around basically contaminated. You know,
they've been
contaminated by politics, contaminated by greed, contaminated by
organized religion. Organized religion is
exactly
the death of any true spirituality.
Absolutely, and of course we could be condemned by as heretics now by all the religions because
more and more people, I think, are feeling that way because there's been a mass exodus from organized religion.
And there's going to continue to be because it doesn't make sense. I mean, you know, I mean, when I saw the Pope, the new Pope, 3 years ago or so, when he came into power, the first thing he did was bless all the Ferrari drivers in Italy.
They came up to
St. Peter's Square in their Ferraris, and he blessed all of their cars. I mean, you know, now this kind of like tells me this guy is a schmuck, okay? And on top of that, okay, and now he...
Well, he told me he was interested in corporations.
And now he comes out with his new edict, okay, that it's okay for male prostitutes to wear condoms. You know what I mean? It's like, what a complete and utter complete boob, all right? I mean, the guy makes a mockery of anything holy about the Catholic Church. And if anybody is a Catholic out there listening, you got to believe me, man. This guy is one major boob. All right, so I'm sorry. But anyway, go ahead. Bonnie, redeem me here.
I am not going to redeem you.
Before I have Catholic Molotov cocktails, I can tell you that by the end of
the century, St. Peter's will be a museum.
You think it'll be a museum?
I think so.
The Catholic Church will cease to exist during this. It might continue in various enclaves and in other forms, but as we know it now, by the end of this century,
the system itself
is going to be a lovely museum.
Well, and I certainly don't mean to demean certain individuals within that structure who are very, very wonderful people, and they happen to be associated with it. And I'm sure there are many thousands of very good people, and we don't mean to demean them. But the system itself, I think, has outlived its usefulness in a lot of ways, and now it's time, as in your book, that people need to take up their personal responsibility to connect with the greater consciousness. And we have the ability to do it.
Yes. I'm working on a new book right now, which is basically saying just that, and getting into the new physics and trying to help people understand what the new physics is actually saying. And the new idea of quote-unquote God, of divinity, that is available to us right now if we will only understand what the new physics has discovered and is suggesting and hypothesizing.
Well, we look quite forward to that book. But right now, you need to tell our listeners how they can get your book.
Well, they can get it from my website, which is BonnieJonesReynolds.com.
Okay.
They can get it through Amazon. You know, get it through Amazon,
right.
And don't be put off by it's supposed to be retail for $47.97 or something like that, and no one in the world's ever paid that for it. From the very beginning, Amazon and I and other booksellers were selling it for less than that. As a matter of fact, I think you can probably get used copies on Amazon at this point for much less.
Okay.
But it's going to be the best money you ever spent, friends, because, you know, how much did you pay for your last pair of running shoes, and how long did it last you? This is a book that, as we've been saying, is going to sit on your desk and is going to be there and give you joy and comfort and understanding and inspiration for the rest of your life. This is just a wonderful thing.
And I think it's a great book, would make a great Christmas present for people to give to family members, and a great book to stimulate some table discussion at your Christmas dinner. And,
oh,
you know,
will it.
And it's been a pleasure having you on our show, and I look forward to your new book.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for calling me and getting me on here tonight. I'm thrilled to be talking to you.
In fact, before we close,
you know what I'm up to.
Before we close, I'd like to invite you on one of my. I'll talk to you about at another time here this week. But I have an internet show that I do with, and we discuss these topics to an extent, especially on Thursday and Friday nights.
Mm-hmm.
Which I would like to invite you on, and I'll talk to you about that.
Sure.
At another date, but I'd like to talk to you at length in this book.
I have phone. We'll talk.
Okay.
Okay. Good night now.
Have a pleasant evening.
Okay.
Good night, Bonnie.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
And
what a lovely
Bonnie
lady.
Reynolds. And
yeah.
You can go to BonnieJonesReynolds.com. And
yes.
Get it right from her, or you can get her, go to Amazon.com.
Give us our station ID,
it's
and then...
WQQQ. What?
All right, I want to thank everybody. I hope you enjoyed that interview. That was our Tuesday night show, and only part of it. It's a two-hour program, but I, you know, for this program, which is only 1 hour, of course the. But I wanted to. I found the book quite interesting, and so did Lila. And we hope to have Bonnie on one of these shows, possibly a Thursday or Friday night program, to discuss this book at length, and possibly to get into the quantum physics that she was talking about as well, which is what we discussed on Thursdays and Friday nights. So I want to thank everybody for joining us, and I hope you had a good time. And I hope you turn in tomorrow when we will be taking a ride through the fourth dimension again. So good night, and talk to you tomorrow.